Is this just an economic soft patch?
Or is it a double-dip recession?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon in for Steve Chiatakis. Good morning to you. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, June 2nd.
Coming up, how did investors change their minds so quickly about the strength of the economic recovery?
Also, Google accuses China of hacking into the Gmail accounts of senior U.S. officials.
And how did the U.S. end up dead last on a list of the happiest countries on Earth?
Those stories and more are coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
The Labor Department is out with the latest on unemployment claims, and although fewer people applied for benefits last week, applications remain stuck at high levels. It's downright discouraging.
Add to that yesterday's dismal manufacturing data and disengagement planned by the Fed soon from its money printing policies, and it's enough to make investors diss the markets to the tune of a 2% pullback on Wall Street yesterday. But why is their confidence up to now so quickly dissipated? Here's Marketplace's Gregory Warner.
Consumers aren't spending as much, and yesterday we learned that companies aren't producing as much. Factory output fell by the sharpest level since 1984. That news, combined with continuing reports about slow job growth and dropping house prices, has investors worried. They dump stocks and put their money into U.S. Treasuries, seen as safer in bad times. Nariman Baravesh, chief economist at IHS Global Insight, said the recent spate of bad news does not foretell a second recession, a so-called double dip, but just means that recovery is always a slog.
So it perhaps shouldn't come as such a big surprise that we have these fits and starts when it comes to growth. But I think there's nothing out there at this point anyway that would suggest we're headed into a true double dip. Slow growth, yes. Double dip, probably not.
By probably not, he put the chance at 1 in 4. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Let's get some analysis now from Diane Swank. She's chief economist with Mesirow Financial, and she's with us from Chicago, as she is every Thursday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Diane, how could so much change in 24 hours?
Well, it didn't really change as much as reality set in. What we saw was a tsunami of factors, everything from Europe, Middle East instability to the reality of the production eruptions from Japan, from the earthquake. There all hit the economy all at once. We saw the ADP report showing a big drop in manufacturing employment, which has been the shining star of the recovery. That'll come back. That's the good news. The bad news is if this economy was stronger, it'd be a little more than a blip on a radar screen.
And I feel like there's sort of a fear in the back of people's mind that as Washington starts to pull away some of the stimulus efforts that were put in place after the financial crisis, that maybe we just delayed the inevitable and now the pain's about to come.
Well, basically, we had a massive coronary when we had the financial crisis, and we're lucky to be alive. What Washington did was put us into intensive care, but we're still in the hospital and rehab is tough.
Rehab is tough. Diane Swank, chief economist with Mesirow Financial, thanks so much as always.
Companies continue to squeeze more work out of their employees. The government said this morning that productivity increased at a rate of 1.8% in the first quarter of 2011. Analysts say this is the limit, and companies are going to have to hire more workers to boost output. But then again, they've been saying that for a while now.
They sure have. In Atlanta today, Home Depot shareholders are voting on political spending. This grows out of a landmark Supreme Court ruling last year that the government can't stop companies from supporting political causes. But shareholders are a different story. Jim Burris reports now from WABE in Atlanta.
Home Depot operates under 8 core guiding values, everything from excellent customer service to giving back to communities to fostering a respect for all people. But Julie Goodridge says Home Depot's political contributions are out of line with that last one.
If you're going to give to political candidates as a corporation, you better make doggone sure that those candidates uphold everything that your company stands for.
Goodridge is CEO of North Star Asset Management, a Boston investment firm. Its portfolio includes Home Depot stock specifically because of the company's commitment to diversity. She says because shareholders own Home Depot, they should decide.
They were giving to candidates who were actively rolling back the rights of GLBT people in the states in which they did business.
Home Depot says choosing how to make political contributions is the role of executives, not shareholders. But the Securities and Exchange Commission disagreed, saying shareholders do have that right. Thus, today's vote. Home Depot is the first of what will likely be a long string of such votes. Bill Busby is an administrative law professor at Emory University.
Certainly other corporations might seek to challenge the SEC's ruling because it will act as precedent for other companies.
Even if shareholders vote to take control of political contributions, the measure is non-binding, meaning Home Depot executives could just ignore it. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Well, the markets may be down, Bob, but you know what's up?
I have no guess.
Ticket prices at Southwest Airlines, they have jumped 39% in the last 5 years compared with an industry average increase of just 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe it's not quite the cheapest option anymore. Southwest blames the rise on high fuel prices, but it says it still considers itself to be the low fare leader.
Mm-hmm. One person's discount is not. For more business news and the numbers from Wall Street, head to our website, marketplace.org. Another D word weighing on the markets is defaults. Moody's has cut Greece's credit rating again, putting chances for a default on its debt at 50-50. Let's discuss this with bankruptcy consultant Jim Milstein, who recently left the Treasury Department after helping unscramble AIG's finances. Good morning.
Good morning.
Greece keeps denying it's going to default on its debt, but what's really going to determine that?
Greece at this point is dependent on the kindness of strangers. Public markets are unwilling to finance them anymore, and so they have to now depend on the kindness of the Eurozone members to help meet or fix their budget gaps. And last year in May, the European Union stepped in, but those efforts have proved insufficient. They're back at the well again, and in order to get through the balance of this year and next year, they need more money. And so if Greece defaults on its debt, it's really a crisis because European banks are heavily invested in the debt of the various sovereign nations.
How much do we have to worry about the dominoes falling?
I think it's a significant issue. You know, it's not as direct a hit for the American economy and the American banking system as the residential mortgage crisis was. But the truth of the matter is the banking systems internationally are very much integrated and intertwined. And so our banks lend to German and French banks, which lend to Greek banks, which invest in Greek sovereign debt. So if they catch a cold, we're going to feel some of the consequences here in the United States.
You know, the global recovery is looking fragile enough in the last few days. How bad would a default be for the economy?
You know, look, economies are a function of the confidence people and participants in economies have about the future. If a major part of the banking system is threatened, it's not good news for us.
Jim Milstein is a former bankruptcy lawyer and former Treasury Department official. Thanks for your insights.
I appreciate the time.
Well, while we're talking about defaults and debt, let's bring in our economics correspondent, Chris Farrell, to help explain some of the terms that have been bandied about. Chris, good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, why, Chris, if we miss a payment on the national debt, are we defaulting? Can't we just have a late payment?
Well, you could, but look, you've broken the terms of the loan. But the real question is, what's the context? If you miss a payment on your mortgage or the rent, you just write a check the next month, pay a fee, no big deal.
Right.
But what if you're Greece and your debt is 150% of the economy? It's on its way to 160% of the economy. And most investors believe they can't continue to make those payments. Default becomes serious.
So they think that you just won't be able to make any future payments if you can't make one.
Under the current terms of the loans.
Well, what about restructuring debt? That gets talked about a lot. What does that mean?
Well, this is the important subject because that means they can't make their payments under the current loans. Let's change the terms of those loans. So one way you can change the terms of the loans is say you can owe us less. All right, we'll reduce the interest rate. We'll reduce the overall amount that you owe us. That's a restructuring. You could also change the terms of the loan by extending the length of the loan. Think about a student loan. Mm-hmm. You have a 10-year repayment. You run into trouble. You extend that out to 20 years. You lower your monthly bill. at the cost of increasing the overall price of the loan over time. But that's a restructuring. That's also on the table.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks for clearing it all up for us.
Well, thanks a lot, Jeremy.
From today's Wall Street Journal comes a story that's a wake-up call for the makers of those five-hour energy shots, the caffeine-packed drinks popular with tired truckers and students amping themselves up to study. Seems they're finding a growing market. Can you guess, Jeremy?
I don't know. Yeah. An emerging world?
No, with the over 60 crowd. Hey, the boomers certainly aren't babies anymore, but this is not your grandmother's Geritol.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
This morning, the U.S. Department of Agriculture will dump the food pyramid in favor of what's being billed as a new healthy eating icon. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
Ask most any public health expert what they think of the decision to retire the food pyramid, and you'll probably get an answer like this.
I think that's a great idea. There's been a very controversial, the pyramid's been very controversial.
Nadi Agrawal is a professor at the Kellogg School of Management. She thinks the new icon should give people visual cues about how to eat well and leave out the sweets and fats that sat on top of the old pyramid. Sarah Bleich from the Bloomberg School of Public Health says the new icon should also be easy to understand.
Americans have very low nutritional literacy, so I think you have to keep the messages as simple as possible.
The new icon is reported to be very simple, a plate shape divided into sections for the different food groups. Bleich thinks it could be a better way to encourage healthy eating, but doubts it'll escape controversy. She says telling people what to eat is almost always contentious. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
The Chinese government this morning is denying any involvement in a Google hacking. Google says Chinese hackers tried to steal the passwords of hundreds of Gmail account holders, including those of senior U.S. government officials, Chinese human rights activists, and journalists. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz has the story now from Shanghai.
The FBI says it's working with Google to learn more about the hackers. Shanghai-based tech analyst Michael Clendenin says it's likely one of two groups.
One is government hackers that have a directive to do it, and the other group are independent Chinese hackers that are just a little ticked off that Google thumbed its nose at China. So no matter where Google looks, it's on the losing side of the game.
Clendenin says this latest news may help explain why Google's search engine and its email service inside China have been slow all year. Google says these latest attacks appear to be coming from the city of Jinan in eastern China. Jinan happens to be home to a military base. There's also a vocational college there that U.S. investigators linked to a previous attack on Google. Clendenin says for Google, it may not matter whether the Chinese government is behind the attack. He says Google's continued refusal to censor its own search engine in China will mean more attacks to come. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
And while we're on the subject of China, Bob, there is a new survey called the Global Happiness Index.
Mm-hmm.
These surveys that talk about which are the happiest countries on Earth. And it says that China is the happiest place on Earth.
I always thought it was Disneyland.
Yeah, right. You would think so. But no, in this study, it's China. And according to the researchers, North Korea is a close second.
North Korea?
Scoring 98 out of 100 in the survey.
Who did this survey?
The top five are rounded out by Cuba, Iran, and Venezuela. The United States, we didn't do so well in this one. No, we came in fact, dead last at 203. If you want to know more about the survey, I would just have to refer you to the researchers who are from North Korea.
Begins to make sense.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.